Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We are here till 5 a.m. It is Monday, and that means my dad will call in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We like to start off the week with a laugh, so my dad's going to call up and tell a joke. We are going to talk about some of the worst lyrics in rock and pop history. Over the years, and there have been a lot of really terrible lyrics. We'll have a lot of fun with that. And The Price is Right is coming to town, sans Drew Carey. But it's Price is Right Live, and you could win some money. And we'll talk a little bit about that in other game shows. All that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, as I said, it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, which we kick off the show every Monday morning with. Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review all the new movies, and then Eric sticks around and we talk about the box office numbers and tell you how they did over the weekend. So we got some movies to talk about here. Let's get the guys going so we can start it. And here's Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So, we got some new movies to talk about. None of us saw Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween.
Nope.
I saw the first one. I don't know if that makes any difference, but I understand that, like, they've really, you know, the advertising, they've thrown Jack Black in to a lot of the commercials, but he's barely in the movie.
Yeah, I've heard so many different stories about this. Like, I mean, he wasn't even listed on IMDb as of like earlier this week.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And now he's currently being listed at like in the like the, you know, you have buried at the bottom and it just says uncredited.
Yeah, well, they put him in the commercials though, so they, I mean, uh-huh. I guess they want to sell some tickets, you know. He's too busy. He's got that house with the clock in it. That's mm-hmm. that's what's going on there.
AKA Goosebumps 2.
The first, yeah, pretty much. You know, the first Goosebumps movie was okay. It was fine. I could think, you know, if I were a little kid, I'd probably really love it because it's, you know, creepy stuff come to life and all kinds of cool stuff. It was fine. And I'm sure this is probably just more of the same. And we'll talk about how it did at the box office a little bit later on. But let's jump in some of the other stuff that we've got to talk about here. Colin, why don't you start with July 22nd.
Okay, well, it's actually called 22 July.
Oh, 22 July. This is Greengrass's new movie, right?
This is the latest from Paul Greengrass.
Man, man.
Currently available on Netflix and also playing at the Landmark Century if you want to see it on the big screen. And it covers the events in Oslo, Norway on July 22nd, 2011, when a guy who was a member of this hate group called the Knights Templar, he blew up a building in the government district near the office of the prime minister, then went to an island nearby and gunned down 69 students and teachers at this summer camp. And in all, 77 people died this day. And, you know, of course, you think, you know, this is a Paul Greengrass film, that we would expect this to take place only on that day, but that's actually just the first half hour. The rest of the movie, which runs a little over 2 hours, covers the aftermath. So we see different perspectives of the aftermath. We see the terrorist himself, played by Anders Danielsson-Lee. He's a very calm, cooperative, and very matter-of-fact about his intentions. And he enlists the help of a lawyer who has to take the case and defend him. So that's one story thread. Another big story thread is of these two teenage brothers, two students who survived the shooting, and how the older one has to recover from being shot three times. He has to learn to walk again. He has to get a new glass eye. So it's very reminiscent of the movie last year, Stronger, with Jake Gyllenhaal. And the film also covers, you know, what the prime minister has to deal with in admitting to the public that his people had intel on this guy, this shooter, and didn't do enough to look into it. So the film has all these threads going on, and it all builds up into a courtroom proceeding. And the terrorist, he's hoping for a particular outcome that will help his cause. You know, like I said, this is from Paul Greengrass. He's the director of Bloody Sunday, United 93, and Captain Phillips. So the subject here definitely fits in his wheelhouse. And the first half hour of the film that covers the main event is certainly, fits in with his filmography as well, in its urgency and the visceral experience of it, the very matter-of-fact nature of it. It's not quite as shaky cam as his other films are. The camera's a little more nailed down this time, but it's still the first half hour of this movie is still pretty shocking to watch. It does have that kind of "you are there" kind of feel to it that a lot of his other films have. Once the movie settles into more conventional terms with the storytelling, it becomes less of this director's work. It's less his signature on it. But I still think it's a compelling film to watch, especially since I'm, not too familiar with the story, and its aftermath and who this terrorist was. The scenes with the terrorists are probably the most compelling, because just how strangely matter of fact and cooperative he is about everything. It doesn't go quite the way you think it's going to go. And I think the performances are outstanding across the board, especially as the teenager who has to go into recovery. Just much like Jake Gyllenhaal last year in Stronger, you really feel this guy's physical pain and what he has to go through. And there's many times when I winced during his scenes of what he had to go through. This is not one of Greengrass's best films, but it's certainly not one of his weakest. He's got a couple weak ones here and there, but I think this is definitely worth watching, definitely worth your time. This is a movie worth seeing.
Okay. That's 22 July, which is available on Netflix, and it's playing at the Landmark Century, and he's playing in Highland Park, too, at the Renaissance.
Right.
Always been a fan of, Paul Greengrass has made some really amazing films. And again, when I heard about this, when I read about this, I didn't realize it was on Netflix, otherwise I would have watched it for sure over the weekend. But when I read about it, I was like, yeah, that sounds like something Paul Greengrass would handle. But it's interesting, how the scope of this movie is different than the kind of things that he's kind of known for, like the in real time, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think it works. I mean, I definitely think that it was time for him to go beyond and just doing the events of the day thing. I think that would have just been a little cliche for him. So I admire that he kind of went beyond that, because there are interesting stories to tell from this story other than just covering the day itself. Yeah. So he definitely made the case for that.
Okay, cool. All right, that's 22 July in a couple of theaters, and it's on Netflix. All right, I'm looking forward to watching that one. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about After Everything, a.k.a. Shotgun?
Yeah, the movie was previously known as Shotgun. It's currently called After Everything, and it premiered at South by Southwest, which I think I might have reviewed it back then, but it was also chosen to be a part of the Chicago Critics Film Festival this year. And it's seemingly a familiar story. Jeremy Allen White, who's on Shameless, which is shot here in Chicago, he plays a young man in his early 20s. Doesn't really have a great deal of direction, doesn't have a great job, parties with friends at night, and is just out scoping for ladies. But then one day he goes to the doctor and discovers that he has cancer. And so this obviously, changes his course direction. But then he ends up having kind of a meet cute at the subway station, with a young lady played by, Micah Monroe. And they immediately, strike up, not just a friendship, but a relationship. And it becomes this story about how one, how this couple is going to deal with his current diagnosis. And that's sort of the basic, premise of the rest of this film. And I think it's an interesting one to follow because we've seen a lot of movies where, the meet-cutes happen early on and then the cancer is, thrown out at the end of the second act and we have to, wait for them to die. It's just your typical Nicholas Sparks type things. But here that element is introduced in the very first act. And, this becomes a movie that is more about living with cancer more than waiting to die from it. And I think that the relationship between these two people is very realistic, very believable. It's funny at times, sometimes hard to watch. It puts it in kind of in the same ballpark, I think, as a movie like 50-50, which is also, kind of mined very similar territory. It's not quite, as good as 50-50 was, but, as a movie that kind of flew under the radar, I actually saw it on the opening night of South by Southwest, and it really kind of struck me, anyone who's, we've all been touched by this disease in some manner, and especially if you've had to live with someone for a long while struggling with the disease, this is a film that really kind of rings true. It's a movie that, deals with, the course of relationship, sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and all of it without feeling a cliche the way that, a lot of movies like that feel. I really recommend this one. I really hope that people will go over to Facets where it's playing and check this one out because I liked it quite a bit.
It's playing at Facets and at the Pickwick.
Oh, okay.
In Park Ridge. And by the way, I want to mention that Dan, I don't know if you knew this or not, but they've got the mega theater for Bride of Frankenstein. They're reopening the Pickwick Theater. I don't know if you guys heard about this, but they're calling it the mega theater. They've redid the whole big theater. They put a brand new screen in that's about the size of an IMAX screen, all new projection and everything. So the Pickwick's main main theater has been totally remodeled, and they're opening it up with a screening of Bride of Frankenstein. That's going to be the first movie that they show in there. And it's on the 18th.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, Matthew Hoffman, who runs the classic theater films cinema, he programs that, once a month they do a movie. And he's opening it up, the brand new theater, on Thursday the 18th with Bride of Frankenstein.
Wow.
That's good news. That's really good news. Okay. Yeah. So After Everything is out there, and Eric is recommending it. Okay, guys, hang on. All right,
and I am too.
Colin. Okay, go ahead.
No, I don't have much more to say about it except that when I saw the title, I completely blanked on until Eric started describing it. I did see that.
Okay, hang on a second. Colin, hang on, okay? I want to get your thoughts on it, let's take a break. Hold on. Colin and Eric are here. We're going to take a break for the news when we come back. We'll get Colin's review of After Everything. We've got more movies to talk about as well. It's Monday morning. Monday morning movie reviews continue after the news. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And, of course, we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we are doing the Monday morning movie reviews. And that's all coming up right here. And we're going to be talking about terrible lyrics and songs, some of the worst lyrics of all time. Price is Right is coming to Chicago. We're going to talk about that and much more. It is Monday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, Monday morning movie reviews are continuing. Before the break, Eric reviewed a movie called After Everything. He is recommending it. And then we found out that Colin actually saw the movie as well. Eric, welcome back. Colin, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Colin, let's hear what you thought of it.
Well, I like I said, I don't have too much more to add to Eric, but I just didn't recognize the title on our list because, and I saw it at our film festival when we played it, and often when we watch our own films during the festival, it's usually in the haze of, you know, a whirlwind of a day, which that was. I think we programmed like late Saturday night. And I expected, at the time it was called Shotgun, I was expecting a movie about, you know, with shotguns in it.
Right.
And I just didn't know what it was, but I was very pleasantly surprised that the movie it turned out to be. And, yeah, I definitely think it's worth checking out. Like I said, I don't have too much more to add to that, but I just want to just throw in that I'm recommending it too.
Okay. So. And I like Micah Monroe very much. Obviously, she was in It Follows.
And her It Follows co-star actually plays one of her roommates in the movie.
Oh.
Olivia Lucardi.
Oh, okay, cool. All right.
Yeah.
There you go. After Everything. All right. Let's see. Colin, tell us about The Hate U Give.
All right. Well, this is based on a young adult novel, but it doesn't center around anything magical or, you know, dopey teen romance, although maybe it starts out a little bit that way. But this actually focuses on racism and violence between black citizens and white police. And it stars Amanda Stenberg as Star Carter, that's her name, and her dad, played by Russell Hornsby, used to be in a gang and who now runs a grocery store, and he teaches his kids exactly what to do if being pulled over by cops. And Regina Hall plays her mom, and she lives in a tough neighborhood, but goes to an elite prep school in a neighboring town and keeps these two lives separate in her head. And she has a white boyfriend who doesn't really know too much about where she lives. And one night she goes to a party in her own neighborhood and she meets an old friend of hers from her childhood, a guy, you know, that she used to know. And he drives her home from the party. They get pulled over. A white cop harasses him, orders him to, you know, out of the car. And then Star witnesses a Laquan McDonald type situation in which an innocent black kid gets gunned down by a white police officer. And the rest of the film is about her fear of being persecuted by, you know, members of her dad's old gang, you know, and whether or not she should testify and go public about, you know, what she saw and what happens, you know, to her friendships at school. And, you know, the more she reveals where she comes from. And so it's a lot for her to deal with. So this has all the makings of a very, you know, compelling movie, especially a compelling teen film. With a central character who is you know, worth our attention, and so the fact that this is from a movie from a major studio and it's based on a young adult novel, but it tackles these themes, is definitely something worth noting. Unfortunately, I don't think the movie itself lives up to what it stands for, and I don't think it delivers as well as the main actress in the movie, Amanda Stenberg, who gives a great performance here. The problem with the film is it starts out very strongly. You know, the first half hour or so is very good. It's setting up everything, setting up the characters, giving them long scenes to, you know, really breathe and flesh themselves out. Once the movie gets into the aftermath of the big episode, it starts to feel, especially in the last half hour, it starts to get bogged down in a lot of cliches and a lot of things, you know, like it's checking a list of things we need to have in the film that is socially conscious about these subjects, you know, the race riots, the injustice in the case, a little kid holding a gun that stops everything. And it just doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel like, you know, the way it's directed, it feels very sort of ham-fisted and over the top. It's directed by George Tillman Jr., whose last film was a Nicholas Sparks adaptation, The Longest Ride. He's made a couple good films, but this is definitely from a director who, you know, just isn't confident enough in the in the source material, which is the book, which I guess the movie added a lot of these things to the adaptation that wasn't in the book, and doesn't trust the audience to get the message itself. It's like it's kind of feels like a social awareness movie made by committee, and kind of dumbed down to sort of suit the young adult audience it's going after. And I think that's unfortunate, because you don't have to dumb this down. You don't have to, you know, hit everyone over the head, you know, with the message. There's one scene in particular, which I saw, you know, I mean, I saw this movie on opening day, with a, you know, sort of, okay, you know, not a big audience, but, certainly a responsive one. And there's a scene in which, Amanda Stenberg is trying to teach her clueless white, elitist, you know, prep school friend, a lesson on, you know, perception on, you know, the situation that she was in. And it's done in such a, it's done in a way that just feels under rehearsed, underdeveloped, and it came off laughable. The audience was kind of laughing at it, which I don't think was the desired effect. I think we were supposed to be cheering or, you know, saying, yeah, you tell him, girl. But it just had the opposite effect. And, you know, that's kind of unfortunate. There's a lot going for this film. And like I said, it's almost, you know, worth sitting through the whole, it's over 2 hours, and it's almost worth sitting through just for Amanda Stenberg's performance, which is great. She's definitely a young actress to keep an eye on. You know, she gives the movie a better performance than it probably deserves. It's noble. It's about important things. I admire the fact that it exists, and I'm okay, you know, with people recommending it to people, you know, to go see, because, you know, we should want studios to make more, you know, to take more chances and make more films like this for young people. But unfortunately, the execution still matters, and the last half hour of this movie, or last 45 minutes of this movie, really just, I thought, didn't work. So I'm getting a very mixed reaction from me. Not quite recommending it, not quite, you know, telling people to stay away from it either.
Okay. All right, that's The Hate U Give, which is out right now, and there you go. All right. All right, let's go. Eric, tell us about First Man.
Okay, well, this is the story of the space race leading up to the July 20th, 1969 landing on the moon. A notable event that we are all aware of through history books. Some of us, not us, but some of us got a chance to live through that moment. And this is told through the eyes of the man who was the first to do it, Neil Armstrong, played in the film by Ryan Gosling. The movie, really is not just about, you know, the days and the months leading up to this, you know, iconic moment. This is a movie that, you know, takes years to develop. It goes into, you know, it's almost like picks up, you know, kind of where the right stuff left off, in many ways, where we really sort of get a sense of the danger that went into this entire endeavor. We meet a lot of the astronauts around Neil Armstrong and his wife, Janet, played by Claire Foy. What this movie ultimately, you know, kind of has going for it in regards to what the story is doing is just how personal it is for Armstrong and his family, particularly Neil Armstrong, whose history is kind of told us was kind of a quiet guy. He kind of kept to himself. Some people described him as a cold fish at times. He wasn't quite the guy that would normally you would think to want to be the sort of the poster child for this momentous event, but he happened to be a pretty skilled pilot and was very much at the forefront of all the tests and the experiments, and he just, you know, he just happened to be the right guy at the right time for this job. But, you know, a particular event as depicted early in the film, shows us a reason, you know, a motivation for why Neil Armstrong might have wanted to go to the moon, and that is the death of his young daughter at a very young age, really a horrific event that would scar anyone for life. But in this particular, you know, instance, is a man that was not great at showing emotion, and that he all his grief was sort of internalized, and is sort of leading up to this, you know, momentous thing. When I reviewed this movie from Toronto, I think I said on your show, Nick, that I made a comparison to E.T. of all films, because in that movie, Steven Spielberg said that the only thing that could get Elliot off the greatest trauma in his life, which was the separation of his parents, it had to be something so momentous, so extraordinary, that it would be the only thing that could, you know, bring him back, from this fill this hole in his life. And that's kind of what you experience here. Through First Man, leading up to, obviously, this iconic moment that is done with such majesty, such beauty. The score by Justin Hurwitz is so wonderful and magnificent that it's not so present throughout the film, but when you get to the climax of the movie, it is really just quite breathtaking. And I mentioned, the idea that this is a film that really kind of shows just how dangerous, how clunky this technology was, as triumphant as it was, and has been glorified, and rightfully so, in movies like The Right Stuff and Apollo 13. It kind of shows you that you really don't want to be an astronaut at this time, because it just feels like you're just being thrown out in a tin can full of rocket fuel, and it's a miracle that anyone survived. So there must have been some really great people behind this thing and in those capsules, and Neil Armstrong just happened to be one of them. This is Damien Chazelle's follow-up to La La Land, and we got Whiplash, La La Land, and First Man, his last three movies, and this is the, you know, the mark of a tremendous filmmaker. It shows that he handles epic type stories through very personal strategies, and this film couldn't be more personal. The controversies that we've heard about as far as the flag on the moon is such nonsense. I really didn't even want to bring it up. But
by the way, first of all, there is a shot of the American flag on the moon.
Of course there is. There's just not one of him planting the flag.
Right.
Which
right.
is garbage. It's just I point out to people who have asked me about this, it's not about America planting the flag on the moon. Okay, this is a very personal story, and yet it tells the story through not just Neil Armstrong's eyes, but it really does give you a sense that there was a space race out there. This, you know, it doesn't deflect from American achievement. In fact, this movie is about as patriotic as you possibly could get, because it shows what America can do when it puts its mind to it and when it has great people behind it. And, you know, if we have the idiots talking about that stuff back then, this probably never would have happened, but it did, and it's now not just resulted in one of the most iconic moments in American history, but I think absolutely one of the best films of 2018.
Okay, all right, hang on, guys. There's Eric and Colin and me, and when we come back, Colin will tell us what he thought of First Man after we take this break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN Monday morning, and we are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and it also means that my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because Monday means it's jokey time. So that's all coming up. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and coming up, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Before the break, Eric told us all about First Man, the latest movie with Ryan Gosling, about Neil Armstrong and the Apollo mission. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back. Eric said it's one of the best movies of the year. And Colin, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it's also one of the best films of the year. And one of the things that struck me about the film was, and Eric alluded to this, is just how unflashy it is, and how sort of very matter of fact it was about the technology and just the sort of clunkiness of it. You really get a sense of just how small the space is, the claustrophobia you feel, when with the shots of the astronauts in these rockets, and you just, I don't remember quite having that feeling on Apollo 13 or even The Right Stuff at times, but this time I really got a sense of like what the technology was that they were dealing with. And that's not a slight on those films at all, but I remember this, it really sticking out this time. It's not, this is the first Damien Chazelle film that is not a musical in any way or dealing with music. Yet there is a strong musical element to it, you mentioned, or Eric mentioned the score, and as well as the use of the songs on the radio at the time is also, very particular and very much in Chazelle's doing. I want to ask Eric, did you see this movie in IMAX?
I did.
Yeah. Yes. I can't stress enough how important IMAX is to the experience of watching this film. And I wouldn't dare dream of giving away what is so special about it, but if you're going to go see the film, I can't recommend that experience highly enough. I can't imagine what it must be like without it. But it is, I think, necessary to getting the fullest experience of this movie. Now, IMAX doesn't always do that, but this one is definitely filmed with that in mind. I think Gosling is really terrific in the film, and sometimes when Gosling is made to just kind of be stoic and unexpressive, it kind of puts me at arm's length of the character and the film itself. And I did feel that way through much of this, but not as I certainly don't mean it as a criticism, because this is how this was Neil Armstrong. And I think, staying true to that was a, kind of a brave choice for a film that is, that tackles this kind of subject matter and could easily be made into a kind of typical, schmaltzy Hollywood product. But this is kind of very rough around the edges film. It's, like I said, not very flashy. And, I also think Claire Foy is worth mentioning, too. I think she's very good as the wife who's, trying to keep him grounded and keep making sure that he's not losing sight of the important things. And it just kind of, the two of them really just bring it home at the end. I just think it's really magnificent where this movie goes. I'm definitely highly recommending this film as well.
Okay. All right. We got a break again, and then we'll come back and I'll tell you what I thought of it. And that is, we're talking about First Man, which was disappointed at the box office. And we'll talk about that later on. We'll break here for the news, and then when we come back, I'll give you my review of First Man and more right here on 720 WGN. Dick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and that means my dad calls in and tells a jokey time. And we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. We'll get back to that in a second. Also coming up, we're going to be talking about some of the worst lyrics in rock and pop history. And The Price is Right's coming to Chicago. Yeah. But right now, let's get back to the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric and Colin both gave their reviews of the new film, First Man. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. I, too, saw it in IMAX, as you should absolutely see this movie in IMAX. And I, too, think it's one of the best movies of the year. This was a movie that... we've talked about just, the way it's shot and the style in which it's shot. It really is a very, despite the fact that, it covers this monumental event and that it's a big, Hollywood production, It really feels almost shockingly intimate. Do you know what I mean? It takes this massive moment in history, and it's this big budget IMAX movie, and it feels like an indie. Do you know what I'm saying? It just has that kind of feel to it, and I find that really unique and really something special. Gosling is great in it. I think it's a great performance, and you know, this is the second science kind of movie in a year that Ryan Gosling played a very stoic character in, and also the second time that it was disappointing at the box office, because Blade Runner came out about a year ago and also underperformed at the box office, and you know, and he gave that kind of stoic performance in that as well. And I think both performances are great. I think he's terrific in this movie. In fact, I think everybody's really good in this movie. Claire Foy is fantastic, and I loved the juxtaposition of the scenes of him, you know, doing these missions with what's happening at the home life. You know, because Claire Foy's got to keep the home front going and got to take care of the kids and all that stuff. And so that stuff is really interesting, and I like the scenes with the astronauts, just the camaraderie of the astronauts, where they're hanging out, maybe just having a beer and talking. You get to know these guys, played by, you know, some terrific character actors that we've seen that are very familiar with. And the wives and their relationships and everything. It's a very humanistic movie, and that's the core of it. As Eric mentioned, the tragedy that happens early in the film really is what motivates the rest of the film. And as you're watching all of these missions that these guys are going on, and it is, and they're terrifying. I mean, they're really, you know, if you're you know, you're claustrophobic in any way, you're going to feel it. The use of sound in this movie is unbelievable. If this movie doesn't get best sound, sound editing, sound all that stuff,
yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, it's amazing. But like when you're with these guys in those capsules, and it's terrifying stuff. It's really scary, and you really realize just what risks these guys take. And there are tragedies along the way too in the film that they don't shy away from, which also makes, you know, the stakes get higher and higher and higher. They also, you know, touch on the political aspect of it, of how people were feeling about, you know, their tax dollars going to this, and you know, how a lot of people in America felt about that at that time. And then it becomes a political pawn, and they touch on that as well. You know, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes long, this movie. It doesn't feel long at all because it's just so involving and just so personal. And everybody knows how it ends. That they make it to the moon and that he's the first guy to hit the moon. And when that moment happens, one, it's astonishing the way the effectiveness of that moment when he actually, you know, is the first man on the moon. And when he says those famous words, it really is powerful, like really, really powerful. You've heard those words a million times. We've all heard it, you know. But it felt fresh. I don't know why. I don't know how Chazelle did it, but it felt like, you know, like it came out of this guy's mouth, you know, just naturally, and the impact of it. And then, you know, people were complaining about, like, not seeing him plant the flag, although you get a shot of the flag. It's not like they ignored that at all. It's there. You know, the American flag is there. But he does something else when he's on the moon, that's really what the movie is really about. You know what I mean? That is what the personal aspect of this movie is. That's what Chazelle is focusing on. And when that moment happens in the movie, I was sobbing. I was in my seat sobbing like a baby at that moment. And it's a real, again, everybody in the theater could hear me because, you know, it's a real quiet moment in the movie. And here I am making a spectacle of myself. And that's the payoff of the movie. And it's huge. It's huge. It's a huge payoff emotionally and everything and symbolically and what the movie really is about. And yes, the very final moments between Claire Foy and Ryan Gosling in the movie is a massive payoff again. This is a great film. It's a great film with great performances. It's beautifully made. It's suspenseful and terrifying and exciting. It's also warm and very humanistic and at times devastating and powerful. and see it in IMAX. I loved this movie. I did not expect to sob like a child during it, but I did. I did just that. And so, yeah, and see it in IMAX. It's absolutely one of the best movies of the year. So that's First Man, and I really wish more people would have seen it over the weekend. I really wish people will listen and go and see it, and if possible, see it in IMAX. So, yeah, that's a great film. So, all right, there you go. That's First Man. Everybody go see it. All right, let's see. Colin, tell us about Bad Times at the El Royale.
All right, well, this is, it's an ensemble film, really, that all takes place at this hotel called the El Royale that exists in California and Nevada, right on the border. So if you're a customer there, you can either get a room in California or you can get a room in Nevada, which is a fun little gimmick there. So among the clientele on one particular evening are Jeff Bridges as a priest, John Hamm is he a salesman? I don't remember now.
He's an appliance salesman, yes.
Right, an appliance salesman. Cynthia Erivo as a professional backup singer for soul groups and soul artists. And Dakota Johnson as a woman who's, hiding something in her room. You'll find out more about that as the film goes on. And the clerk running this hotel on this evening is played by Lewis Pullman, who gives the same spiel about the place to everyone who comes into the door, and whether they want to hear it or not. So over the course of this evening, these characters cross paths multiple times. We learn that not everyone is who they seem to be. Their pasts catch up to them. And then Chris Hemsworth comes in and really shakes things up. So there's a lot of twists and turns and surprises in this movie, so there's best left unsaid, I guess. So this is directed by Drew Goddard, who made Cabin in the Woods many years ago, which we all enjoyed. And that was also full of many twists and turns that we didn't really see coming. This movie is a little more conventional than that film in terms of, the kind of surprises that it delivers. It's been sort of compared to, Tarantino's work. Obviously, there's an influence there, no question about it. And someone said this feels like one of those, late 90s knockoffs of Tarantino's, the kind of wannabe films like, Your 2 Days in the Valley and Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead and Feeling Minnesota and all those kinds of movies. I think this is much better than that. It definitely would fit in. It definitely would be accused of that at that time. But I think enough time has passed. We're more removed from that we can still enjoy this movie on its own terms, especially because of the cast. The stuff between Cynthia Erivo and Jeff Bridges, I think, is the best stuff. John Hamm is as usual, very funny in this film and it's a role that requires him to be, that sort of funny kind of, weird off-center way. But I do think, though, that the first two-thirds of the movie are stronger than the last third. I don't think the movie ends up quite isn't quite as interesting where it ends up as it was to the buildup of it. A couple of characters come in and really kind of turn things around, but I don't think in a way that really kind of caught me off guard. This movie kind of goes where I sort of expected it to go, and I'd kind of wish that it had surprised me a little bit more in the last third. That being said, though, I do think this is an entertaining film, filled with characters that I enjoyed getting to know and filled with twists and turns that I enjoyed discovering. But I just think the strength of it is in the build up more than the payoff. But I do think this is a movie worth checking out.
Okay.
If you're in the mood for some dark humor and violence and, you know, nasty stuff.
Right. All right. Okay, guys, hang on. And Colin and Eric are going to hang on, and we're going to take a break. Colin just reviewed Bad Times at the El Royale, and he is giving it a good review. And we'll find out what I thought of it and what Eric thought of it after the break. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What's happening? It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. It's Monday morning. We're going to also be talking about terrible lyrics, some of the worst lyrics in rock pop history. The Price is Right's coming to town. And it's the Monday morning reviews, which we're in the middle of right now. With Colin and Eric, and Eric will stick around, and we will talk about box office as well. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on WGN. All right, before the break, Colin gave us his thoughts on Bad Times at the El Royale. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Eric, what did you think?
I think this is a great movie, and I think it's a great movie for reasons that extend beyond the kind of the surface level storyline with the kind of the Tarantino like twists and turns that we might come to expect in a movie like this. Drew Goddard, who did The Cabin in the Woods, famously, that was a movie where he kind of bended the genre expectations, that we had with horror movies. But here it's not so limited, because what I see this movie as being, is a complete commentary on the sins of America in the 1960s. Everything from, government surveillance to race, to cult leaders, to all these kind of things, the Vietnam War, figures at one point in the end of the film, and it's a movie that is viewing these characters through that prism. And while it's giving us this incredibly, I think, incredibly entertaining film, with I gotta say there at least more moments in this movie where I was like shock jumped out of my seat than I think any movie in recent history. I mean, they're just moments of, whether it be because of a loud noise or shocking death or something like that. I think I counted four moments where I was like, good God, man, I'm not expecting that to happen at that moment. So you have all that, all that stuff is a lot of fun to be had. These characters, some of the a couple of twists and turns have been spoiled by trailers or TV commercials and things like that. So it'll be a lot more fun if you haven't seen any of that stuff. But it hardly spoils the experience, because, Colin mentioned that the relationship between Jeff Bridges and Cynthia Erivo, who is also is in Widows, Steve McQueen's film, coming out in about a month. I think that whole episode, which becomes, it feels like an ensemble movie. It feels like, we're going to get, we follow certain characters through certain periods and whatnot, but those two characters are really kind of the heart of the film, and they're not just, thrown to the side, early on. They, they form a, sort of a, there's a completeness to them, that goes through the movie. And the affliction that Bridges' character has, also kind of feeds into the idea of how we want to, forget the worst elements of the 1960s and just reflect on what the hotel purports to represent, that it feels like it's this, the way that Lewis Pullman's character describes what this hotel is, that you can go on the California side, you can go on the Nevada side, both sides have their, their pleasures and whatnot. But this, we see that this is a hotel that is just not, it is not really functional anymore. He's the only one there, and he's got, he's got his own issues. And so this feels like, something that's been left behind, a relic of a past age. And it's just something that, some of these characters can't get their mind around. And I think that's going to be the same way for the audience too. And I think this is Jeff Bridges' best performance since The Fisher King. Honestly, honestly. I think he's that good in this movie. And I really got to give it up for, I think Lewis Pullman is not getting the kind of recognition that he deserves for this movie.
He's great in it.
The son of Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
And he, again, a character that seems like is going to be a throwaway. He's going to get a few laughs and then be tossed aside, which is not the case. Because when we find out like the full arc of his character, I think it's not just a tremendous moment for the audience, but I think also just puts into focus what this movie is really trying to be. I think it's a tremendous performance from him, and I think everybody in this movie is really good. Really up to and leading Hemsworth. I think the movie is very suspenseful in the third act. I didn't feel it let up at all. I think it kind of it ties everything into a nice little bow by the end, and by the end I was fully satisfied by the arc of this movie, and I had the feeling walking out of this movie that this was going to be the kind of film that was going to be rediscovered and talked about and reevaluated many, many times over in the future, the way that we see more and more of these days. I think it's that good a movie.
Okay. All right, we're going to break here, and when we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric, Colin, hang on, okay?
Yep.
All right, you guys are going to hang on. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Bad Times at the El Royale. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, we're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here on 720 WGN. Here until 5 a.m., 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke and lots more stuff. But we're finishing up the movie reviews here. Eric and Colin both reviewed Bad Times at the El Royale. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, I'm with you on this one. I think it's absolutely one of the best movies of the year. And I think it's a great movie. And I think everything that you said is absolutely true. This movie, first of all, let me just say this. The soundtrack is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, my God. The music is just the soundtrack is unbelievable. And I'm assuming that a third of the budget went to it. But I do think it is a movie that is about something and really does touch on a lot of things that were happening in that time period in the late 60s, and doing it in a very clever way and a very insightful way. And there's a lot of emotion in this movie. This isn't just an exercise in style. You know what I mean? It's
right.
It's not, there's more going on here than just being a flashy sort of Tarantino-esque ripoff. You mentioned Jeff Bridges' character. Jeff Bridges' character, what's happening in it with him is deep and significant and moving. Same said with Cynthia Erivo. She's great in this movie. It's a terrific performance, and there's a lot of layers going on here. Dakota Johnson and the relationship with her sister in this movie is really interesting, and then how that's connected to Chris Hemsworth, who was essentially playing, like a Charles Manson type character. And John Hamm, I don't want to give anything away, but there's, stuff that happens with him that is very timely to what was happening at that time. And then Lewis Pullman, the emotional connection at the very end of this movie. There's a scene at the very end of this movie, and I won't give it away. But it really was. I mean, it was more than I had expected. I expected a lot of fun and twists, because Cabin in the Woods was a lot of fun and there was a lot of twists. And I love that movie. And I think Cabin in the Woods is one of the most creative and best, horror films of the past like 15 years. So I really love it. But this movie goes much deeper than that, much, much deeper. There's profound stuff happening in this movie. And yeah, I mean, you could say, that it's got, you could say that stylistically, because they have the play cards to tell you, what part of the story is next. And it does mess around with the timeline. And so immediately you're going to think Tarantino. You know what I mean? That's what you're going to think. But I think there's more going on than just this being like, aping Tarantino's style. There's some real deep, significant stuff happening here with some really, really deep and three-dimensional characters that have a lot of stuff going on. I think this movie's great. I think it's funny. I think it's shocking. I think it's clever. John Hamm, I just love John Hamm. He's really, really funny in this movie. Every time he said accoutrement, I laughed my ass off. And just the whole spiel at the beginning of the movie is great. I think Dakota Johnson is really good in this movie as well. There are certain reactions that she has to what's happening that I think are really, really funny. Nick Offerman shows up briefly. You don't really get to see his face, but he does.
Yeah.
Nick Offerman does show up. He's in it. I just think this is great, great stylistic stuff. I think Drew Goddard is a terrific filmmaker. And he's also, listen, he directs, is executive producer and he directs A Good Place on TV. So he automatically gets a pass as far as I'm concerned. because the stuff that this guy comes up with, I mean, he's part of the Lost team. And I mean, he's a real creative guy that tries to work outside the box and yet, grounded in some sense of reality with realistic characters and some real emotions. I didn't think that this was just simply an exercise in style, and I don't think it's just a retread of a Tarantino movie. I think it's much, much, much more than that. And I have to say that the Saturday afternoon that I spent in the theater for 5 hours, because they're both really long movies, they're both the same running time, by the way. First Man and El Royale are 2 hours and 21 minutes. They're both that long. It was like the best afternoon I've spent in a movie theater probably for the entire year. Like back-to-back watching First Man and then seeing Bad Times at the El Royale. I was like, wow, okay, this is as good a movie day as you can get. So I think they're both of the movies that I saw this weekend, I think are two of the best movies of the year. So... anyway,
both films take you through the entire 1960s.
Exactly, that's the other thing. And what's his name is in both of them. He plays Jeff Bridges' prison doctor, and he was in.
Shea Whigham.
Yeah, he's in both of them. I was like, oh, it's going to get a little double feature. but anyway, that's Bad Times at the El Royale. It was a good weekend for movies, and unfortunately, the two movies that we just talked about, nobody went to see. which is unfortunate. Okay, so what do we got next week? Next week we've got Halloween.
Yeah.
And is anything else opening?
It's the only major thing opening. Only big. I mean, I think there's some other, like, I think Beautiful Boy opens.
Okay.
Here, so some small releases, limited releases that are expanding, but Halloween is the big one.
Halloween is the big one, and it'll probably be number one by far.
Monster.
Yeah, it'll be huge. It will be. Yep.
I gotta mention the McHenry Drive-In. In McHenry, Illinois, they are going to have a double feature of the original Halloween and the new Halloween.
Oh.
On Friday.
That's cool.
Next weekend.
That's cool.
So I'm definitely going to try to go to that.
All right. That's cool. That sounds cool.
Yeah.
All right. Very, very good. All right. Well, Colin, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Sure.
You can tell us all about that your experience at the drive-in.
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. Okay, there you go, Colin. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week. Eric, let's talk box office.
Yeah.
What the hell, man? Venom. Come on.
What the hell is... That's all I need to say, really.
I mean, come on. $35.7 million, $142.8 in 2 weeks. Wow. I can't believe it.
There must be a law somewhere. We always joke about the law that, you have to see the new comic book movie that's out. But that's the only way I can explain it, because I don't know anyone that likes that movie.
Yeah, I don't either.
It's not even like it's one of the DC movies that you get all the DC fanboys up all, frothed about because, no one likes them.
Yeah.
I don't understand it. I don't understand how, it was headed for like a 60% drop, which I even thought was not bad, considering the movie. I thought it was going to drop a lot lower.
Yeah.
Or a lot higher. I kind of thought that it would be number one this weekend, but by a very slim margin.
Yeah.
Over the number two movie, and it just didn't happen. So, I mean, I don't, it looks like this movie is going to make $200 million now. I don't know why, though.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't get it. I just don't get it. All right, number two, A Star Is Born, 28 million, 94 million in 2 weeks. This is a hit.
Yeah, this is you know, what we've been talking about for several weeks, and we talked about last week that the word of mouth was just tremendous for this thing. And it's as October releases goes, it's the fourth highest 10-day release in October history. And that includes Venom.
Yeah.
It's like Venom, Gravity, The Martian, and A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
So there you go. So, this movie is headed for somewhere easily north of $160 million. Mm-hmm. We're going to see if it hits that 200 mark.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to... I still think it's going to have legs. I still think people are going to be seeing it, you know. Number three, very disappointed. First Man, $16.5 million. I'm very disappointed with those numbers. I was hoping more people would see it. And more people need to see it.
Yeah, I am too, and I don't want to believe that the flag controversy, you know, played into that a bit, that 35% of this country heard that and stayed away from it. I'd like to think that we're a smarter country than that, but, you know, you never know. But I think, honestly, I mean, if I'm being real practical about it, I think that Universal screwed up in where they released this movie. For one, they released it. They probably didn't think that the Star Is Born juggernaut was coming.
Yeah.
Okay, so they probably didn't figure that. But you know, a couple weeks ago, they probably got a little scared when they saw the reviews for this thing and it was going to have legs. So all the adults. I mean, I was at a family get together today, and the only movie anyone asked me about again was A Star Is Born.
Right.
Did you see it? Did you see it? And they all saw it. And then I had to tell them, like, okay, now you have to go see First Man.
Yeah.
That was what I told all of them.
Yeah.
Like, go see it. Like, oh, yeah, I'll definitely go see that. But so I think that they screwed that up. And Universal, who released First Man, next week they're releasing Halloween.
Yeah.
So they've played against themselves. Now, I guess, you know, they're certainly playing the long game with this for the awards and whatnot. But, you know, a $60 million production, you know, I think that if they were to release this thing maybe around Thanksgiving...
Right.
They might have had a better, a turnout. They might have had even better legs. Now, I think this movie is going to have some legs. You know, I've got a kind of an estimate somewhere between 55 and 75 million still right now, because that's what the history suggests of movies that are this good and that are probably going to be nominated for Best Picture in October. So I think that there's still some hope for some legs to this thing.
Yeah.
But if this thing drops off next week, then I don't know. I give up.
Yeah, I know. I'm very disappointed. Number four, Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, $16.2 million. How did the first one do?
First one did like 23.6.
Total?
Yeah.
Oh.
No.
The opening
million
weekend.
Total.
Oh, 80 million.
Opening weekend was 23.6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was already lower than the opening weekend. I don't see this thing, getting, far over 50 million, even if that.
Mm.
I mean, 16.2, I think, is a little better than what they're expecting this weekend, frankly. But Sony also cut the budget in half on this one, and maybe some of that was Jack Black's salary, who knows, but it only cost $35 million, so they were smart to realize that, without any kind of star power, that they were relying on just the brand name.
Right.
So I think, they made the smart move, but, I think this movie is going to, be making its profit on home video.
Got it. Number five, Smallfoot, $9.3 million, $57.6 million total.
Yeah, not particularly strong numbers. It has legs, clearly, family entertainment, but they're not huge numbers.
Yeah. Six, Night School, $8 million, $59.8 million. Is that low for Kevin Hart, or not lately, because he's not been making...
Well, it's low for Kevin Hart, but it looks like his movie is probably going to end up turning in profit. I mean, it's headed for probably north of 70, to 70, 75 million. It's low for Kevin Hart, but that's still not bad for, a budget this small.
Right. Seven, Bad Times at the El Royale, $7.2 million. That's about what you expected, or a little bit less.
Yeah, no, I kind of I didn't think the movie was going to hit $10 million. I mean, they've advertised the heck out of this thing, but, we love Jeff Bridges, but he's not the biggest draw in the world. and, it's just, these ensemble hotel movies. they take place in Transylvania or have John Cusack in them, these hotel movies don't do very well.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you,
Hotel Artemis.
I'll tell you, well, yeah, which is another really good movie, but
yeah.
I'll tell you, it was packed. There were more people. This is weird. We went Saturday.
Yeah.
There were more people in attendance, and this was in Skokie, at the theater in Skokie. There were more people in attendance at El Royale than there were at First Man. I don't understand it. Seriously, I was like, really, when people kept walking into the theater when we were sitting in the theater for Bad Times, I was like, what the hell? What's going on?
It's really funny. You know, we touched on this earlier, too, but you saw two movies back-to-back. One is about the best of America in the 1960s, and the other one's about the worst.
Yeah, right. It's true. It's very true. Number 8, The House with a Clock in Its Walls. It's up to $62.2 million. Number 9, The Hate U Give, 1.7, 2.4 total. That's very disappointing, considering it's in a lot of theaters, right?
It's actually not in a lot of theaters. No, it's only in like 240 some theaters.
Oh!
So that's actually a pretty decent number.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think the ceiling is going to be very high for this, but for given the amount of theaters that it's in, that was one of the better per theater averages in on the list this week.
And A Simple Favor stays in the top 10, which is cool. 52 million total. There you go.
Yeah, it's a nice little send off for that movie.
Yeah,
one last week in the top 10, gets over $50 million, a $20 million budget. Again, hopefully Lionsgate puts a little money into that for the award season because I think somewhere they have a chance.
Yeah. Okay. And what are we looking at numbers wise for Halloween? What do you think?
Oh man, I want to say it's going to fall. It'll fall short of It numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking somewhere in the 60s.
I would say that's about right. I would guess that's about right.
Yeah. So I mean, the name recognition for this thing. I mean, I'm in the minority on this thing that I think it's bad. But a lot of people are praising it. So it doesn't matter. People are going to show up next week. They'll make up their own minds.
Yep.
But this movie's going to be a huge hit.
I got my tickets already.
I'm ready. Yeah.
So I'm all set. All right, man. Well, we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Take care. There's Eric Childress, everybody, and we will talk to him again next week, and we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN.